everybody. Welcome to the Value Add Podcast, where we inspire entrepreneurs through real life stories. And today we have an amazing real life story from my good friend and serial entrepreneur, Ron Corey. Ron?
Thank you, Matt. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Perfect. We're so happy you're here with us. I'm so excited about this story. I've read Ron's book years ago. We've been friends for 10 years. He invested in our company when we first started back in Fund One. But I got to say, it was amazing to go back and reread his book. There were so many nuggets in there, so many takeaways. We're going to share some with the audience here today. But what I find, just to start off with, Ron's been involved in so many different disparate businesses, car washes, travel agencies, casinos, bars, restaurants, limo companies, a car sales company.
Car dealerships.
Yeah. Thank you. Have I missed any?
It's a long list. People have to buy the book. I need to refresh my memory sometimes.
But
about 20 different businesses.
It's amazing because I'm in the real estate business, but to be in that many different businesses, perhaps that don't overlap, and to learn about the nuances to those businesses, to me is really quite amazing. And maybe we'll get into how you did that, how you kind of developed your partnerships, and how you ran all these different businesses simultaneously and had a family life at the same time.
Much like you, I went from being a dealer to a realtor to make extra money. I sold real estate by day and dealt in the Tropicana Hotel at night. And you got your start in real estate. So we have walked in similar foot markings.
We have. And there's a lot of interesting similarities that Ron and I actually crossed paths in many different areas, perhaps in different times, but still a lot of similarities there. With that being said, why don't we start from the beginning in your life, growing up in Brooklyn, New York?
Sure.
Kind of your upbringing, family life, friendships you've made growing up on the streets, and how that's kind of impacted the rest of your life.
Well, my grandparents immigrated here from the Middle East in the early 1900s. My mom and dad were born in Brooklyn, and as was I and my brother. I only have one sibling, and went to school there, lived with my parents until I enlisted in the Marine Corps. I didn't finish college. I wasn't well suited to being a student. So I opted to enlist in the Marine Corps, and I got lucky and had an option after boot camp to select where I wanted to be, and I stayed in California.
Okay.
Actually, the aptitude testing that the military provides, if you score in high enough, you can actually select from duty stations that are available. And growing up in New York, being a fan of Beach Boys music, I saw California and thought, oh, I'd love to see California. So I ended up at Camp Pendleton after boot camp in San Diego. And then my final duty station was Barstow, in the middle of the desert between Las Vegas and San Diego. There's a big supply center. And it makes sense because it's served by a large rail line, so they could store equipment, rifles, tanks, jeeps, in a desert where there'd be no rust, but put it on a rail car and have it in San Diego in a couple hours, put it on a ship and get it wherever the world needs the United States to bail someone out.
So interesting. A lot of similarities there. I also, you know, didn't cut it as a student, didn't have great aptitude, you know, couldn't get the grades. But I found it interesting because in your book, you went to, correct me if I'm wrong, Baruch College, which is in Manhattan. Right.
Yeah. Brooklyn Tech High School into Bernard M. Baruch University. I attended it. I didn't graduate it.
Same here. I went to Borough Manhattan Community College, which is down in Chambers Street, which is actually right close to where the World Trade Center used to be. And I was there for 9/11, actually, that day, only six blocks away. And it was quite a scene. Tough day. But we have those similarities in City New York community college system. So, but going back to Barstow, so you were there, you were kind of, did you have a culture shock leaving Brooklyn and ended up, you know, you had these dreams of the Beach Boys and Southern California. How was that for you going from Brooklyn to Southern California? Because I kind of did the same thing as you did there.
Yeah. Well, at 19 years old, I was looking for something new. I loved growing up in Brooklyn. I had great lifelong friends. I'm proud to say some friendships today don't last more than a couple of years. People move on.
Yeah.
But the guys that my parents and their parents grew up together in the same streets. So many of my friends described in the book knew each other's parents and grandparents because they all grew up together. So it's nice to have that kind of history and continuity as our parents would take us on a summer vacation. Our dads all got 1 or 2 weeks off from work a year, and we planned trips to the Catskill Mountains or Lake George, New York,
yeah,
and vacation with friends, get to know them almost like cousins. And we've actually, there's about 10 of us that have stayed very close. I just had 3 of them visit me from the East Coast last week, stay at my house and spent a week together.
And these are friendships you've had for 60
years? Since we were 6 to 10 years old.
Wow. Yeah.
And our dads knew each other.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You don't see that too much anymore.
Yeah, it's a rarity on the West Coast because it's so young compared to centuries on the East Coast.
Yeah. Yeah. Another little fun fact, you mentioned you guys went up to the Catskill Mountains. As you know, that's where I'm from.
Yeah.
Originally. And I think you said you went up to Tannersville.
That's right. Where we used to go to a hotel there.
Okay.
In Tannersville. And yeah, small town with a creek you could fish in. It's just, I would compare it coming from a big city environment to what I saw on TV with Mayberry. Tannersville was much like a Mayberry town.
Yep. Where I'm from is a town called Phoenicia, very similar to Tannersville, probably 10, 15 minutes away.
Mm.
So right in that same region. And people from New York City, understandably, love it up there. They could go up, relax, hike, fish, hunt, do all those outdoor activities, get away from the hustle and bustle.
You know, it seems like fate keeps throwing us together because while we didn't know each other there, we were blocks apart. While we were blocks apart on the East Coast, we later learned as we got to know each other, I built a casino on Decatur Boulevard in a neighborhood casino environment. And you had the gas station on
across the street, Vegas.
Catty Corner.
Yeah, Vegas Drive in Decatur.
Incredible.
Small world. And my family's from Brooklyn originally, too. So,
oh, yeah.
Well, in Williamsburg. So,
oh, that's where my high school was.
Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of similarities. But just for a moment, you know, what kind of stood out to me and resonated is you talked about your dad a little bit in the book. Mm-hmm. And he was a World War II vet.
Yeah.
And he... I'm not sure he had some medals of honor in battle that he received. And what you mentioned to me kind of struck a chord because my grandfather was in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And my father always tried to talk to him about, you know, what happened in the war. And he refused to ever talk about it. And it seemed like
my dad never talked about it. I had no idea. I knew he served in the Army, but he never talked about it beyond that. And then after he passed and I had to go through things that my mom asked me to go through. It was too painful for her. And I found all these certificates of award that went along with a medal.
Yeah.
And I asked my mom where the medals were because these medals for bravery and seeing a lot of action in World War II in the Philippines area, Japan, she said he was so disgusted by what he had to do and what he witnessed in war. When he got back to Brooklyn, he threw all his medals away into the ocean.
Uh-huh.
And she kept the certificates because they knew each other as kids.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to say at least I helped them survive. And it's very moving to go through that bit of history.
Yeah. Yeah. They were some tough guys back then. That was a tough generation. And I wish our culture and you know, our generation were a bit more like them. Make life a little bit easier, I think.
I'd like to think your kids and my kids are learning from us, so we're helping to build a generation that might our parents and their parents might be proud of.
Yeah, pulled some of those values from the old days.
Absolutely.
So looking ahead here, coming from Barstow, how did you end up in Las Vegas? It was the early 70s, right?
Yeah. Growing up in Brooklyn, my mom and dad... In my household, my mom's sister hadn't married, so she lived in our 4-story brownstone, along with my grandmother, grandfather, mom and dad, grandparents on my mom's side. And my mom's sister ended up falling in love with a guy and marrying him who lived in Vegas. And She moved out here to Vegas to be with him. And when I ended up with a California assignment, you know, eating in the mess hall, in the Marine Corps environment or any military environment, home cooking is a dream come true. So my aunt invited my buddy and I, who I met in the Corps, Dan Hughes, to stay with them on weekends. We had a Monday to Friday type assignment on the base. So we would drive in on Friday night, stay at my aunt and uncle's house, enjoy the Vegas environment, and go back Sunday night to report for duty Monday morning. While I thought I was just killing my days off, I found Vegas to be a town with 200,000 people. I came from Brooklyn, millions of people. Here I saw a lot of opportunity, a lot of potential. And I spoke with Dan at length. He was from South Philly. And I talked to him about giving Vegas a shot before we went back east. And he and I moved here and ended up working for people. And then years later, started our own business and grew that to a number of businesses. And Vegas became our home.
So when you moved out here, you know, and Dan, by the way, is also a friend. Dan, you've been so kind to refer, has been an investor in Crystal View for a number of years. And we'll get into your partnerships with Dan, because you've had a lifelong partnership and friendship from this acquaintance that you made back in the military in years past. But when you came out here, you were a dealer, right? You at the drop?
I got a job downtown where most people start to break in, develop the mechanics of being more proficient. And it was a little place on First and Fremont called the Carousel.
Okay.
I started there.
It's no longer there, right?
No, there's another place on that corner.
Okay.
It's gone through a couple of generations. But I worked there for 6 months, got proficient in two games, because I felt like many people, if you're lucky enough to get a strip dealing job, back in the 70s, if a casino manager wanted to put a nephew or niece to work, your job could be gone.
Yep.
There was no union protection. And I thought if I dealt multiple games, I'd have more value to the hotel. So I learned blackjack, roulette, eventually craps and baccarat to make myself more valuable and maintain job security. So ended up doing that. Thankfully, never really needed it, but it was good to know multiple games and helped me get a strip job at the Tropicana and be able to afford to raise a family and invest in a business, which Dan and I parlayed into multiple businesses.
And that first business, was it Suburban West was your first business?
Suburban Lounge West was an existing tavern that I found for my casino boss. He asked me, as a realtor working in the casino at night, to find him a business to buy for his daughter to run and for him to invest in.
Okay.
I identified a local tavern. And this was before there was video poker. Traditional slot machines didn't make a lot of money in neighborhood bars. So you had to actually make money selling drinks.
Just to put things into perspective, what would the old school slots typically bring in? What did it bring in back at
a couple of thousand a week?
Okay.
Nowhere near the tens of thousands a week
that you see
slots
today.
Now generate with video poker and multi-game machines, multi-denomination machines.
Yeah.
It's really grown that industry.
Yeah.
But when Dan and I got into the bar business, you actually had to sell drinks, meet and greet people, and get them to come back to your place as opposed to the other places along the street. And we were very lucky. The bars succeeded. We were able to parlay it into multiple locations, eventually buying land and building our own locations. And it's been a great town for opportunity. And I think it still is for many people.
What made you decide to go into business with Dan on that bar? Was that a dream that you guys always had?
Oh, no.
To go in business together?
I met him in the Marine Corps. So we had a great friendship. And if you meet someone in the military, you're willing to entrust them with your life and safety. And when Dan and I were done with our active duty service and moved to Vegas, when I had an opportunity, I'd run it by him. When he had an opportunity, he'd run it by me, because we were each other's potential partners in any business.
Wow.
So that's how, when I found this bar opportunity and I went and talked to Dan about it, he had an interest in partnering. So we did that together.
It's tough to replicate trust.
Yeah.
They're the most more valuable than money in a lot of instances, right?
No, you know, it's hard to do it and have it succeed, which many businesses can tell you how it didn't work and why it didn't work. And I've been lucky times too. I had a partner in Dan in the gaming and liquor business. And then I made a friend later out of Texas who invited me to join him in the car dealership business.
Don, right?
And Don Tamburo.
Yeah.
And he ended up enjoying Vegas so much, he moved here from Texas and lives here now.
Well, I'm excited to get into that story. I wanted to point something out from the book. And by the way, would you mind holding up the book? And we're going to share a link to this. For those of you, I want to share this book, Tenacity. And it's a perfect title. Look at that handsome man on the back right there. What a perfect title for what this man's life story is about and what he's overcome. And I've read the book a few times. It's also available on Audible for those that want to listen to it, right?
Yes, it's on Amazon. There are other books named Tenacity. And so finding it by the author, Ron Khoury, is the way to nail it down. But it's got this great red, white, and blue cover
with
a picture of me on the back. And it's on Amazon and it's on Audible. And I'm happy to say that when I needed to get an audio version made, I had seen Dean Cain on a news program. And I remember watching him play Superman when my kids were little on ABC in the 90s. And I had my PR people reach out to his management team in California, brought him to town to record my audiobook. And I'd like to say that he had such a great visit. He ended up selling his home in Malibu and moving here. And he's now a Nevada resident, as are his parents.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
What a story. Now, is the movie still in the works with Dean?
Oh, it absolutely is. In fact, there was a screen producer, screenwriter that he's made over a half dozen movies for.
Okay.
Named Jason Campbell.
Okay.
Who Dean introduced me to. Jason lives in Virginia. Jason read the book, wrote a draft script of it, emailed it to me recently. I need to go through it because all Jason could write was what he learned from the book. And my book is under 300 pages to make it marketable as a book.
Yep.
But the original story was 900 pages long. So the editors narrowed it down because I couldn't decide what to cut out. So as I go through my notes of what the original story entailed, I'd like to think the movie will have things that people who read the book weren't able to visualize. So when I go through Jason Campbell's script, I'm going to be able to add things that people who read the book wouldn't know about, hopefully make the movie even better. And Dean Cain has signed on to portray me in my life story.
Superman and playing you.
I'm very excited about that. I grew up with George Reeves in a black and white Superman series, and I'm a big fan of that Superman storyline. So to become friends with Dean Cain and have him act and portray Ron Khoury in a movie is a dream come true.
I think it's fitting.
Thank you.
I can't wait to watch it.
Thank you.
And speaking of stories, there's a few that stand out to me. Back to Suburban Lounge West, there was one story that I think showed your creativity on full display. If you wouldn't mind sharing it, there was a wall and it was kind of blocking your patrons from getting into the bar, and you creatively at night, you know, got some guys together. I think you gave each group kind of a case of beer type of deal, and you got rid of that wall.
Most bars have a lot of construction workers.
Yep.
After 2 p.m., you know, they work when it's cooler, starting at 5 or 6 in the morning. So most bars have a lot of construction workers for patrons. My bar was in a shopping center that bordered a utility building, and there were access lines, large pipes on a dirt lot running to a reservoir, and there was nothing on the other side of the wall but a dirt lot. And if that wall weren't there, I would have 30 more parking spaces. And being on the end of the L-shaped shopping center, people would have to park around the corner. Thankfully, our business was good enough that our original lot would fill up. They'd park around the corner in front of a Smith's and have to walk around to get to the bar. And I felt if I could make access to the bar easier, our business would be better.
Sure.
And I was sort of daydreaming, talking to customers one day about, boy, if that wall wasn't there, I'd have 30 more parking spaces right outside my back and front door. And these guys, one was a guy who worked on demolishing things, operated a backhoe up the street, was the lot that they stored trucks on.
Okay.
And another guy had a dump yard he owned. So these guys said, you know, for a couple of beers, we'll take that wall down and haul it away. And it just will be there at 2 a.m. and be gone at 3 a.m. And I said, you know, I don't know what's involved with doing that. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But if that wall was gone, I'd be a very happy guy. And sure enough, the next day, the wall was gone, hauled away and all. And that dirt lot was there for the entire time Dan and I owned that bar. And we had those additional 30 parking spaces. And it did, in fact, help our business.
And not only that, you got very creative with some signage, too. I think you had a truck that you painted or created a mobile sign out of.
It was, the county wanted me to take down the 4x8 wooden sign, claiming it violated the sign ordinance. So we bought an old Ryder rental truck from the Ryder company and had it much like any business will put vehicle lettering on their trucks. And we made it the Suburban Lounge, a customer courtesy truck where my customers could use it to move. It had a loading ramp on it. It was a moving truck.
Yeah.
But you backed it up to Spring Mountain Road and it was bigger than any sign you could ever get approved. And it actually helped our business significantly.
So what I find interesting, and this goes back to that entrepreneurial spirit, is, you know, there were some code violation issues. And I know you talked about it. You figured out a way to legally get what you want and to appease the county commission at the same time, which I think his name was Manny Cortez.
He was the county commissioner for our area, lived up the street from the bar. And when the code enforcement officer started giving me trouble about the truck, I went to see Manny, and that went very well.
I think there's a quote from the book that's fitting. I wanted to read it. It says, remember, if you're going to play the game, always read the rule book. And if a call doesn't go your way, don't just sit there and take it, put up a fight. You never know. Things just might break in your favor.
There you go. You typically get told you got to take a sign down by a guy with a code enforcement badge, and you do.
I love that.
That sign directed a lot of people to the bar, and we could put specials below the Suburban Lounge lettering with Ryder signs, and it did help business. And Manny called this code enforcement officer up to his office when I was there, and he said, has Ron broken any laws or bothered you in any way? He said, no. Why are you picking on him? He said the sign had to go. He took it down. Now he's got a truck and the truck runs. What's your problem with Ron? He said, none. Then leave him alone. And the guy left us alone and we had that truck. Well, in fact, we had it for years. And then when Dan and I developed a bar on Sunset Road called Thirst Busters, we had it relettered to promote Thirst Busters.
That's great.
Yeah, thank you.
I think there's a common theme throughout your life, and it's certainly your entrepreneurial life, is you always followed the rules, which I admire about you, but you always got creative, and you always stood up firm for what you believed, and not only for yourself, but friends, business partners. You always wanted to be on the side of what was right.
Yeah, thank you.
There was another example of this during that time. You said that there was a fight going on in the parking lot. I think you were leaving in the evening, and you noticed that somebody was beating up a police officer pretty badly, and you ran as being the great civilian that you are, and you stepped in and helped rectify that situation.
Actually, I was getting to work that night.
Okay.
And there was a police car on the access side to where my bar was, but I had to park in front of the Smiths because the lot was full. And as I'm walking to the bar, I see a car running, and as I turn the corner, this guy is thumping one of the patrol officers, and every bar owner worth his weight knows the officers assigned to his area.
Sure.
And Danny was this patrolman who I knew quite well. He would do bar checks. He'd stop in. Hey, Ron, everything okay? Everything going well? And so this guy's thumping Danny big time. And I ended up jumping in and pulling the guy off him, and the brawl was on. It was a big boy, and Danny and I ended up teaming up on him. He was on something because
he wouldn't stay down.
You couldn't get his hands behind him. Two good sized guys. Before my cancer, I weighed 185. I was in great shape.
Yeah, you were
at a record.
Pictures.
So we each had an arm and we couldn't get them behind them. And some creative kicks got him to give in.
Okay.
We got him cuffed and Danny was able to free up a hand and get on his lapel mic and call for help. And then the town lit up with lights and sirens. Guys coming to help a cop who's calling for help. He's in a fight.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was quite the opportunity to do the right thing.
And that wasn't the only time. There was another time, I think you were saying you were driving a client around and you saw someone snatch a purse.
Snatching on Tropicana in the Strip, yeah.
Yeah, you jumped out of the vehicle while it was still running and kind of bullied this guy.
I was a realtor showing property.
Okay.
I witnessed a purse snatching. And the guy ran into the Tropicana parking lot, which I was familiar with, having dealt there years before.
Yeah.
So I got out, caught him. I didn't realize I left the car in gear. Thankfully, Jack Mastro
hit the brakes,
reached his foot over and hit the brakes and saved the car from running into some parked cars. But yeah, I caught this purse snatcher. And between that and the other incident, the sheriff at the time awarded me an honorary deputy sheriff's badge, which was quite the thing. I hadn't even heard existed.
And you're not even a police officer.
No, I wasn't. But he said, this is an honorary deputy sheriff badge. And every successive sheriff we've had since then has renewed the certification. And I'm proud to have the most recent one framed in my game room and carry the badge as a wallop.
Wow. And that came to serve you many times throughout your business career, where you had run-ins with altercations and you could go back to your connections because you were always on the side of the law and you did the right thing. These guys helped you out in instances in the future with
yeah.
Gungster and some of these other
exactly
people that
right.
we'll get into. But I
yeah,
did.
If you're carrying an honorary badge that the sheriff gave you and a policeman shows up to an altercation that you're in, whether you're catching a purse snatcher or whatever you're doing, you're going to be deemed a good guy when they're trying to decide who's telling them the truth.
Sure.
If you get your, you don't want to flash it, but if you're getting your license out to give them a C and they see it, well, you can't help that. Right.
I need to get one of those. On that note, let's talk about Wounded Blue Foundation. You've been so kind to invite me to some of their dinners. Maybe you could talk about why that's near and dear to your heart. You've given, a lot to this organization over the years.
Sure. It was founded by a retired Metro cop named Randy Sutton, who I was friends with when he was a patrolman, stopping at my bar as he stopped at many businesses. When he was a patrolman, he later became a sergeant and a lieutenant before retiring for medical reasons. And we've remained friends now for over 25 years. He comes to my house to play pool once a week. And he founded the Wounded Blue, which is a charitable organization that helps officers in jurisdictions where if it's a small town department and they can't provide everything the officer needs, after an injury on the job,
yeah,
the Wounded Blue charity helps where they can. And Randy founded it, asked me to be on his initial board of directors. I've remained on it now for over 10 years. And it's a very worthy charity that Randy operates.
Amazing.
And it does good work around the country.
Amazing. We'll include a link to the charity for anybody who's watching this that has an interest in learning more.
Or it would be awesome.
And giving back. The next thing I wanted to talk about is one of your next business ventures, which I thought was also interesting, is when you started Presidential Limos.
Oh, yeah.
Which was that in the early 80s or was that in the late 70s around that time frame?
That was in the early 80s when people need to realize that years ago, if you got pulled over and you'd had a few drinks,
yeah,
you weren't in an accident. You just got stopped.
Yeah.
An officer would make you park your car and get a cab home or walk home.
Yeah.
And because of liability concerns and the way societal changes have developed, it's more serious now.
Yeah.
So as the enforcement of drinking and driving became greater as a society, I saw a possible use for more livery vehicles. So looked into opening a limousine company, and I learned that while this town had about 100 limousines serviced by two companies, most were what they call airport limos, slightly extended,
yeah,
but mostly to accommodate luggage and get people from a flight to the hotel. And I wanted to provide a luxury stretch limousine service, which there were only 8 stretch limos in the entire town.
Wow.
So there was a niche for it. I felt companies weren't really outfitting their drivers the way I envisioned. My drivers all had tuxedos, a driver's cap, and not just a black jacket. And
so they gave roses to the ladies and had champagne.
Single step rose for every lady in the reservation. While all limos had wooden bars in them, they didn't stock them. I put bottled waters in them and one complimentary bottle of champagne.
Classy service.
So we named it Presidential, and there was a company in San Diego by that name, and I thought it was a great name. And the company did very well until we were approached by an existing company to buy us out, and ended up selling the company and did well on the sale. In fact, that's how we ended up buying the land and developing the third of multiple neighborhood casinos. And
I think that was Winners in Opportunity Village, right? Or Opportunity
City? No, that was the Castaways on Decatur.
Okay.
We funded, yeah.
From that sale.
Yep.
So there was one story that kind of stood out to me. When you own Presidential Limos, the company that had the monopoly was not happy about you being their competitor.
Right.
They wanted you out of the business very badly.
Well, legally, they could be an intervener and object to your licensure, which is how they financially drained or mentally drained a prospective competitor. And people just would get denied or give up and not want to continue the hearings where you need to keep paying your attorney to appear. And
but not you.
It's very expensive. No, I'd like to think I was a little tenacious, hence the name of my book.
Yeah.
But we fought them and prevailed. It was the first limousine certificate issued in over two decades.
Wow.
And opened Presidential. And it did well enough that the competitors decided to stop suing me and Dan and just buy us out.
Yeah. There was one story you mentioned in the book that they would call your house, talk to your wife, make death threats. There was even a time where you said, hey, I had a mirror that I would actually look underneath the chassis of my car in the morning before I turned the ignition because, I don't know, I didn't want the car to blow up. I mean, it was a crazy time.
There was a car bomb at Tony Roma's on East Sahara that went after a guy. It's a true story, and I read the paper every morning. And when I was, my number was listed because I was a working realtor. People need to find you when you're a real estate salesman.
Sure.
So my number was accessible and cell phones weren't a thing yet. Not like now.
Yeah.
So people would leave nasty messages threatening me on my home number and make my wife at the time very scared. I worked hard to try to identify who that might be. And I believe I did. And people who read the book will find out more about that little tidbit there to entice a potential book reader.
Absolutely.
But we were able to, if there was any doubt that I found the right people who were doing that, the fact that I confronted them in an empty elevator and the calls, the threats all stopped after that encounter.
Yeah.
I knew I had the right people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're being kind. You did whatever it took.
And,
and that's what really stood out to me. You did the right thing. You followed the laws, but I'm telling you, one of the things I thought when I read this book was if you weren't an entrepreneur, you'd be a hell of a detective. You would figure out what was going on. There was always something going on that you had to really think outside the box to figure out. You'd figure it out, and then you would learn the angles and figure out how to propel your business forward.
I'd like to think it's a Marine Corps mentality, because when Dan and I were working in the Marine Corps, we were assigned guard duty together. And we'd walk guard duty for 8 hours overnight, protecting the armory or the gate or whatever. And we talked about, after the service, being cops together and hadn't contemplated if it would be in Vegas, but we were visiting Vegas on weekends to stay at my aunt's house and get 50-cent drinks at the old El Cortez.
Yeah.
When you're on a low military salary, that really mattered.
Sure.
Anyway, yeah, we talked about being cops together. So you mentioned I could have been a detective. We thought about it and ended up in Vegas, but going into business for ourselves. And that worked out a lot better, I think, financially.
Well, yeah, that's what I was just going to say. I think financially you made the better decision.
Yeah.
Speaking of detectives and speaking of stories, this one is kind of a story within the story. Winners Casino in the City of Opportunity. I mean, it's just a hell of a story what you guys went through, and with this waiter, and I mean, this guy Gunster, which I presume is an alias, by the way,
yeah,
which is a city council member.
When my book first was coming out, I didn't want a beef with a local city adjacent to Las Vegas to possibly create litigation and keep my book from being released. So I changed some names because the story is still just as interesting.
Yeah.
But it was actually the city of Henderson. The bar Dan and I were building was Thirst Busters.
Okay.
Casino.
Okay.
And we renamed it Winners and created the city of Opportunity, Nevada, back then, to not delay my book release.
Yeah.
But now it doesn't matter. The book's out. It's a bestseller.
Yeah.
It's going to be a movie. So I'm okay with people knowing exactly where that was. In fact, anyone who lived here, it was on the front page of the paper about me being denied, about me suing the city of Henderson, and then about us prevailing in court against them. So anyone who was here reading the papers would know everything that I'm telling you. So yeah, it was quite a time in Las Vegas old history that we lived and prevailed in.
So Thirst Busters, you were supposed to have 199 slot machines, correct me if I'm wrong, 8 table games and a sports book is what the zoning allowed for, right?
When we applied, there was no limit. That's why we bought land and built in Henderson, where Las Vegas and Clark County jurisdictions had limited machines to 15 in one jurisdiction and 35 in another. Henderson had no such limit because they were trying to create more growth. They were a small town. So we bought the land there because of that. And during the time it took to go through licensing and plans and build a building, they changed the code to something called limited gaming, which was 199 limit and 8 table games, which was okay with me because we weren't build a building that would accommodate more than that anyway. But the law did change to create more or create less competition for the existing hotels, which were big contributors to Henderson political campaigns.
Yeah.
But it was a law change that didn't really affect us. Once we got approved, well, we didn't never really got approved. We had to take them to the state Supreme Court, which I spend quite a bit of time on in the book to describe how we overcame these obstacles. And won in the Supreme Court of Nevada to be able to operate a non-restricted gaming location in Henderson and then create that value, whether the operation deserved it or not, and get the price that I thought I should get for the sale of it, because Dan and I were in the printing business, several bars. So no one location was something I wanted to own forever.
Yeah.
But we created this value in getting that license to where we could get a great price for it.
Yeah. What I find interesting and very unfortunate, and it just shows your tenacity once again, is this city council member, you had this by right use. And because he was a competitor of yours in an unrelated business to Thirst Busters, he basically did whatever he could, in fact, concocted a story and tried to frame you and make you go to prison for 50 years.
Exactly.
Just so you couldn't get the license that you were entitled to get. Maybe you could share kind of the short version of that story, because I find it so interesting.
Well, I had to make some assumptions, which my book says, because there was no one else I was posing when these unique events occurred, but taking a story where we caught a thief who worked as a server in one of my places, my managers caught him stealing and manipulating the register. We confronted him with that. He tried to run when we confronted him with the evidence, and my guys tackled him and held him and called the police.
Yeah.
They claimed he ended up hiring a legal team because we were viewed as a deep pocket, I believe, and to settle it for nuisance value. And I wasn't into settling when I felt I was in the right.
Yeah.
So we fought it, and we actually had to defend ourselves in criminal court, because if what he said was true, we committed assault and kidnapping and battery, and we were just keeping him there till the cops could come and show them the proof we had that he was a thief. But winning the long game is more important than winning the short game. And my story goes into that detail. And I'd like to further entice your listeners to get a copy of Tenacity and and read the whole story.
Absolutely. I tell you, that story by itself about Winner's Casino is kind of like a thriller. That could become like a movie within itself. It's very interesting. I don't want to ruin it.
Yeah.
But it's very exciting part of the book.
You.
Yeah. Very exciting part of the book. Where did this never quit attitude come from in you? Do you think this is something that was like innate, something you were born with? Was it cultivated over time? Why do you refuse never to quit, no matter what happens?
I don't know if I was spoiled as a child, but in the Marine Corps, you're trained to never give up. And when Dan and I pursued something we thought we were entitled to, and have someone for political reasons or their own personal financial gain screw with us, just didn't sit well.
Yeah.
And I remember meeting with Dan one day, and he said, boy, we're paying the lawyers a lot of money to fight these guys. Is it worth it? And I said, well, we've got so much invested, I don't think we should walk away, but we're partners. I'll defer to what you want. But if we can prevail here, there's the sale of a business that's worth millions compared to a business that's just worth 100 or 200,000. And I think it is.
But I think it goes beyond business for you. I mean, well, and again, not to spoil the book, but when you had cancer, if you don't mind us talking about it for a minute, I mean, there was a moment where you thought that you weren't going to make it. You actually came home, told your family about it. And when the doctor told you about it, the first thing you said is, we're going to war.
Yeah. Well, you know, esophageal cancer kills 92% of the people that get it. Either the cancer gets them or the surgery does, because the surgery is about 12 hours long. I developed it, and my doctor told me that I should go home from Santa Barbara, get my affairs in order, because the likelihood of not surviving it was high.
Yeah.
I took it literally and made sure my estate plan was in order, met with people I was friends with but hadn't seen in a while to say goodbye. I'm going into the surgery, and the odds are I won't make it, but it's been great being your friend. I love you. And
yeah.
And went through that effort to tell people that mattered to me goodbye. And then I beat the odds and was very lucky to get a great surgeon and survive esophageal cancer and a stomach resection and all the things that came with that. And I mean, what you get when you're in a hospital bed for 30 days is clots in your leg. Any of these clots could break loose, and you have a stroke if it's to your brain, or a heart attack if it's to your heart. And all those things happened. Not the stroke, but
yeah.
I had blood clots, and we had to treat that. And they thin your blood so the clots break down. But they had given me so much blood thinner, I had blood oozing out of my tongue. So they had to adjust that prescription to stop that from happening. But it's been quite a life, and I'd like to think it will motivate people who get bad news, whether it's in business or in health, to not give up. And demonstrate some tenacity of their own and fight a good fight and hopefully prevail in their case.
Well, you've certainly done that.
Thank you.
What advice would you give others? I mean, when you were going through this and you didn't know if you were going to live or not, you had blood clots, you were a very healthy guy, you were in great shape. You said you ran 3-4 miles a day, you lifted weights, to all of a sudden now you're just laying in a hospital bed. You have no energy. How do you, when it's easy to fight when you're on top, right? When everything's going your way, hey, you know, it's easy. But when you're on the bottom and everything's stacked against you, what gave you that drive to keep fighting?
I'd like to think my dad was a great example. You know, he fought in World War II. He never talked about it. But after he passed, I went through some boxes of storage things he had, and I found all these certificates that accompanied medals. And I asked my mom, Where's all these medals I'm reading Dad got? She said he hated what he had to do in the war so much. When he got home, he threw them in the river. We live very close to the East River and Hudson and Eastern Brooklyn. And he threw the medals away, but the certificates my mom saved, and I've got them. And it's quite a thing about what they call the greatest generation. You know, that you hear a lot of people on the news today say, if not for that generation and how they fought in the 40s, we'd be speaking Japanese or German today.
Probably.
And it's probably true.
That's right.
So I find my dad to be a great inspiration to me. Although he's been gone now over 15 years, I miss him every day. And my kids were able to know him when they were younger. And it's a great thing to carry on a tradition and be a good patriot, proud American, and live a good life that you can be proud of and your kids can learn from.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing role model you are for your kids and for the rest of us. Speaking of your children, you know, I'm friends with your son, Tommy.
Yeah.
And your older children, Joe and Angela, right?
Yep, Joe and Angela.
And one thing that you, another thing that you did that, that I admire a lot is, I know your late wife, Joni, had two children, and in the book, it said that she felt like, you know, her role has passed and, you know, the kids have grown up and she really wanted to be a mom, and you guys kind of got together and you adopted Tommy, I think in the early 90s, right?
Yeah. Joan wanted to have more children, but due to a hysterectomy could not. And she said, you know, I'm not really a business person. I raise kids. It's what I love to do. And when you couldn't have any more, what do? You adopt.
Yeah.
So I found a great adoption attorney, family attorney, Ishi Kunin.
Okay.
She had her own practice and she made it one of her missions to meet mothers who were pregnant and didn't believe in abortion and match them up with potential adoptive parents who could help her with the expenses that she couldn't afford and then get the child through adoption. And that's what happened in our case. She set us up with someone who was pregnant and pregnant with Tommy, who now is 30. I can't believe I'm that old, but Tommy is 30, and Joey and Angie embraced him like a typical brother and sister. For people thinking of adopting, it's a great experience. Bring a baby home and raise him like he was yours. And Tommy knows he's adopted and has thanked me many times for giving him a life that he wouldn't have had otherwise. And now Tom's visiting. He's living in Thailand, got a job running a hotel there. And he's in town visiting for 3 weeks, coincidentally with your podcast. And he's staying at my house with his girlfriend, Georgia. And we're enjoying a couple of weeks together before he goes back to his job in Thailand. And Joey and Angie come over on Sundays, and now they get to spend Sundays with their brother.
What a blessing.
Thank you, man.
So for others out there that maybe they've had kids or they can't have kids, sounds like you would highly recommend looking into adoption.
Oh, absolutely. You're doing a great service for a mother who loves a kid enough not to have an abortion,
yeah,
but can't afford to or doesn't want to have another. It's been a great experience. And honestly, Tommy's part of the family, though he's adopted, no different than Joey and Angie in my heart, in my mind, and with his brother and sister. So it's certainly something people should look into, find a good family law attorney, or reach out to Ishi Kunin.
Yeah,
and
if you live in Vegas.
Yeah, it's been a great experience. And now that Tommy's 30, which I can't believe, we got him as a newborn from the hospital after he was born. And I certainly recommend it to people that want to have children.
No, you're a great father, and what you've done is admirable. So
thank you, Matt. That's very kind of you.
Absolutely. So kind of going back here a little bit in time, when you beat cancer, you know, you moved on with your life. And you decided, hey, I want to keep fighting. I'm blessed to live another day. And you got back into business. And it was around that time that you and your good friend Don got into the car dealership business. Maybe you could talk about that.
Sure. I like to gamble a little bit. Nothing in excess is healthy, whatever it may be, particularly gaming. But having been a dealer, I'd like to think I was smart enough to know the pitfalls. But I developed a little gaming system for Baccarat that I enjoyed playing.
Okay.
And one of my casino hosts at Caesar's Palace named Elmo, he's still there, in fact,
okay,
all these years later. He said to me, you know, Ron, because Elmo and his and some other hosts there, Bob Reagan and Mickey Rosenberg, all great guys, all great locals. Elmo said, I have a customer comes in from Texas. And you guys are a lot alike. You need to meet this guy. Next time Don's in town, I'm going to call you. So he introduces me to Don during a visit. Don would bring his different dealership managers that had a good month into Vegas for a Vegas trip. And Don and I ended up becoming friends, playing Baccarat together. And when he sold his car dealerships to Roger Penske, ended up moving to Vegas. Lives here now.
You brought someone else out to Vegas.
Yeah. We were great friends. And when he moved here, he had sold his dealerships. And then years later, he thought about getting back into it, asked me to join him. And we purchased Planet Hyundai and ended up purchasing a couple of more dealerships together. And it was a great experience learning the car business from Don. And we've sold them now, but remaining his friend and getting together once in a while for dinners or lunches is something I look forward to. I've been blessed to have two great partnerships, one with Dan Hughes and one with Don Tamburo.
I think that's a great segue here. How did you, I understand with Dan, but what advice would you give others that are thinking of going into business with someone else in a partnership arrangement? What traits would you look for in a partner?
I think anyone who has had a good experience in their own business knows that they need to trust their gut. And when you meet someone and you say, that's my kind of guy,
yeah,
whether you just want to spend time with them socially or go into business with them, when you meet someone like I did with Dan in the Marine Corps, ended up going into businesses with them here in Vegas, and then later when I met Don, they were both my kind of guy, and I guess I was their kind of guy, because to entrust someone with going into a partnership with them is more than a marriage.
Sure.
You know, you're putting up money. You're going to work together. You oftentimes spend more time with your business partner than you do your family.
Sure.
And
you got to choose.
Don was that kind of guy. And our partnership has proven that to be so. And our friendship has survived the sale of our businesses. And Don has ended up living in Vegas and liking it. And we look forward to getting together whenever we can.
That's wonderful.
Thanks.
So back in 2009, I mean, you got in when a lot of people were running for the exits. We were in the middle of the great financial crisis.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's the time to buy, by the way, when blood is on the streets.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that and that tough time that you guys pulled the trigger and bought these dealerships and grew them quite remarkably.
Well, any downfall in any economic scenario is an opportunity for someone else.
Yeah.
In our case, someone who had car dealerships and was not seeing the sales they were seeing when everything was great, decided to sell. And when Don asked if I'd consider going into that with him, I thought about it. And while I love Don and we were great friends, I even more so loved having seen his dealerships in Texas. As a friend, I visited there and he ran his dealerships the way I ran my businesses. They were spotless. They were well run. You could just see it. You could feel it. And I said, Don, I'm honored you'd ask me, and I'd love to be in business with you. And we ended up with multiple locations.
Henderson 2 and Centennial.
Henderson Kia, Planet Hyundai, and Planet Hyundai Centennial.
Didn't you even go out to Monterey, California as well?
We did acquire some dealerships in California, which turned around and built up and sold.
Wow.
And it was a great experience. And now Don and I are both in our 70s. And while we dream about doing it again, we highly scrutinize anything we're going to get into, because I know, speaking for myself, I don't have the energy I once had. But I told Don, if you ever want to do it again, buddy, I'm in with you.
Good for you. You're willing to pick up your sword and go back at it, aren't you?
Well, when you love what you do, it's never work.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
Isn't that the truth?
So if Don found the right dealership, I would do it again with him in a heartbeat.
And you guys grew your revenue at a great clip. I think in the book, it was mid-20s. Level percentage-wise growth from, I think it was 11, 12, 13, and then you sold in 14, right?
15, I think.
15.
Yeah. So during an economic downturn, opportunities presented themselves. We took advantage of it, found dealerships we could get at the right price, built them up. Now, part of being in the tavern business with locations all around town, I was so lucky to meet thousands of people, meeting and greeting customers in my bars, that when I put out the word with newspaper press releases, that they liked doing business with me as a customer at my taverns. And if you need a car, give me a call.
Yeah.
And sure enough, the phone would ring 10, 20 times a week. People looking for a car or looking to help a relative who was getting a car. And we drove a lot of business through our dealerships because they knew they liked doing business with me. And I could help drive business. And with Don's expertise in the business, running the numbers and you know, picking the right inventory to purchase.
Yeah.
And me helping to bring customers through, it was a great partnership.
So you were more the operational guy. He was more the finance.
Don was the operational
guy.
No, I just helped drive the customers through.
Okay.
And introduce them to a salesman or a sales manager.
Okay.
And make them feel like, you know, they knew someone at the business. They weren't just walking onto a lot. But Don was the guts of the operation. He knew the car business.
So you kind of brought that old school casino mentality where you took care of your customer and you brought it and adopted that into the car business.
Yeah. Many people are very uncomfortable walking onto a car lot. You know, they don't do it but once every 10 years. Cars last so long.
Yeah.
So feeling like they knew someone in the car business helped drive traffic.
Yeah.
And then our people would take care of them. Once I introduced them to someone, the customer introduced them to someone at the store.
Word of mouth.
People were comfortable with it. Just like the bar business, we were successful in with that personal touch.
And it's interesting. The same thing in my business is, you know, you take care of your customer. No matter how big your business is, no matter what business you're in, at the end of the day, we're here to serve our customers.
Yeah.
Tell them the truth and serve them well. And when you do that, it seems like business, it just comes in the door.
Yep. You know, you met me looking for a piece of property Dan and I owned. Cole called me, somehow got my home number, which was not listed.
Yeah.
But we ended up with the initial phone call, ended up being a meeting, even though I wasn't looking to sell. You convinced me to do it. And our friendship and partnership has grown from there. So, I mean, I didn't take on investments very lightly. I said, if I'm going to invest with you, I need to do a background check.
Sure.
And many people who approached me wouldn't release a social date of birth and approve doing a background check. And I said, well, I don't know what you're hiding, but I'm not going to go into a business with you if you don't want to cooperate in checking you out. And you had no problem. You and your wife gave me the information, and my private investigator said, these are good people.
When you got nothing to hide, why not?
There you go.
You know, and it was an interesting story because I called you personally, and that was a Fund One investment, as you know, 2975 South Highland.
Yeah.
Exactly. Which was a good deal for us, and hopefully it was a good deal for you.
I was just a seller of a commercial bit of real estate.
Yeah.
Never envisioning it would develop into a multi-million dollar investment with Crystal View Capital 2 and 3. But I have, well, honestly, I've invested with you so many times now that the proof's in the pudding.
Yeah,
I've got great faith in what you do, to where I put my money where my mouth is. And you've proven to be a great friend and a great fund manager. So I think it's a perfect wedding of minds.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And it's been a great partnership, a great friendship,
and
a hell of a ride. And I appreciate you being here with us today. I think just a couple more pieces, words of wisdom from you, just given how disparate you've invested and gotten into business, again, through car washes and car dealerships, bars and restaurants and casinos and limousine businesses. How do you determine which opportunity? I know, as an example, in the limo business, you talked about filling a niche, but how do you say, I want to get in this business versus that business? And how do you choose your timing?
You know, it all just develops because Dan and I were in the bar business, and then Don and I were in the car business. And when this car wash that was near one of our taverns closed, and I used to use the car wash.
So it would complement one another.
I thought, wow, I wonder why the car wash closed. They always seem to do good business. And I looked into it. It was California owned, these two guys, and they wasn't doing the numbers. I don't know if they were getting ripped off by employees or what was going on. But I thought, I think I could run a car wash. It's just another business.
Yeah.
Treat your customers right. They'll come back.
Yeah.
And back then, I think a car wash was $1.99 or $2.99. And it was an automated line that the car ran through, and the brushes and the blower. And then we had hand dryers at the end that would dry the car. And the Spring Valley Car Wash did very well for us. And we parlayed it into other things, just like we did the bar business.
Yeah. I think there's another good quote I want to read. I think that ties right into this point. It says, a decent businessman who made well thought out decisions, was good with customers, and was honest and savvy could operate almost any business.
Yep.
Once you ramped up on the specifics of an industry, you applied the same philosophies to the new business that you'd applied to all others, and success was highly probable.
I wrote that in the book when I was creating the book, and it was a how-to book that I was trying to write for potential entrepreneurs. And that those words from a decade ago ring true today.
Yeah. So post Planet Hyundai and in your car dealership, Fourier, you guys did extraordinarily well on your exit, I understand. What did you do next from there? How did you decide to make the decisions you made? I think you, after that, you had a good stint as a poker player and enjoyed that process. And in fact, you were on the front page of a poker magazine, weren't you?
Yeah. Card Player magazine asked to do an interview with me and put me on the cover. When the book came out, actually, the cover has me holding the book up. And they did a nice multi-page story in Card Player. One of the father and son that own Card Player are poker players. And coincidentally, I live on a lake, and they live across the lake from me on the water. Contacted me to do a story for their magazine, and I did. It actually helped my book sales and, you know, different things. When you're in business, you got to get creative. You've got to find ways to make people want your product, whatever it is you're selling.
Yeah.
In this case, I wrote a book, so I wanted to sell the book. So getting a celebrity like Dean Cain to do the audiobook was one thing that helped. And then marketing it in a variety of ways helps you meet other people that you never know where those links are going to develop. You reached me to buy a piece of commercial property. Now look where we're at.
Yeah.
Crystal View became a thing. I became an investor, and you've grown to a great degree on your own with managing the fund. These things just happen, you know, like me meeting Don playing Baccarat at Caesars and then going into the car business with him. Meeting Dan in the Marine Corps, walking guard duty, talking about being in business for ourselves someday. All these things just evolved as you get a good gut feeling about someone.
I think at the end of the day, and tell me what you think about this, it's all built off relationships.
Yeah. Right? Oh, absolutely. If you meet someone and either have a bad experience or don't have a good gut feeling, you're just not going to pursue anything with them. But when you meet someone and you say, that's my kind of guy. In my case, it was with Dan Hughes, Don Timburo, and Matt Riccardella.
Yeah.
And I've continued relationships with all three.
Yeah. I think the old axiom rings true. If you want to get a good partner, be a good partner.
Ain't that true?
And you've done that for your whole career.
Yeah, I'd like to think I was a good partner and good friend. And my partners have all done the same.
So well, I'm proud to be your partner.
Well, thank you, Matt.
I just want to end with one final quote that's really, really hit home for me in the book. It says, the only constant in life is change, and with change often comes controversy, sometimes even danger. You must be prepared to move forward in the face of whatever stands in your way of your goals and dreams.
Yeah, that was a great line I wrote to summarize my life story, because things of value don't come easily. There are going to be challenges, and challenges are not for everybody. Some people are very happy, and I don't begrudge them. Their choices.
Yeah.
You know, if a guy wants to be whatever, electrician, a plumber, a contractor, and that's all he does for 30 years and he retires, God bless him. I like diversity. I like finding new challenges. As my story in my book tells, all these things, you know, subsequent bars were related, but then going into the limo business or going into the graphics business with Dan, that was something he knew, invited me to join him on. But growing the business, it's all the same goal, is to grow with new customers, treat them right, and develop a business growth philosophy, and then run the business in a way that's profitable.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a common trait in a great business person is a curious mind, mm-hmm. and you're constantly challenging yourself. The status quo is never good enough.
Right.
You got to go to the next level, and that comes with pain, and not everybody could withstand pain.
And the only constant is change. Changes in the industry you go into, changes in the competitive environment since you first got into it, and you need to identify that change and accept the challenges that come with it to prevail.
Yep. And prevail you've done.
Thank you, Matt. As have you, sir.
I appreciate that. Well, this was fun.
Thank you much. I appreciate the invitation.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming out.
Okay. Buy Tenacity on Amazon, folks.
Absolutely. you.